So reading from Mark chapter 8 and verses 27 to 38. And Jesus went with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they told him, "John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, and others one of the prophets." And he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Christ." And he strictly charged them to tell no one about it, no one about him. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." And he called to him the crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his life? For what can a man give in return for his life? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels."
I'd be grateful if you could take the purple books back open and turn once again to page 23. I'm speaking from a shorter section than the one we've just had read to us, but from verses 34, little number 34, about 8 lines up on the right-hand side at the bottom there of page 23 and through to the end of the chapter. It's been a privilege to be with you on the barge this week. Those of you who are able to come to one of the dinners in the week, it was great to see you and to begin to talk through some of the questions that you have as you investigate the Christian faith. I think inside the little pamphlet of papers that you were given when you came in was a question slip. And if anything occurs to you on the way through the talk this evening, anything from the passage that doesn't quite make sense, or any other questions about the Christian faith that you want to probe us on a little bit more, if you scribble those down, then I think during refreshments at the end, is it that the way it works, someone will come round and collect up the questions and we can have a go at trying to work through some of those a bit more afterwards. Let me read you verse 34 on page 23 there as we start once again. That he is Jesus. He called to himself the crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." Well, the title of this whole week of events has been Surface Tension, and our aim has been, unashamedly, I think, to get beyond some of the routines of life, just the things that keep on occupying our minds the whole time, some of the trivial questions that dominate so much of our media, and to focus instead on the absolutely fundamental and life-changing claims that stand right at the heart of the Christian faith. And we've seen that right at its very core, and it may have been a surprise to one or two guests, I suppose, this week, Christianity isn't in its essence about doing religious stuff, nor is it even about trying to be a good person. At its very heart, Christianity is relational. And there's the possibility on the table that you and I, people just like us, could be friends with the awesome, majestic Creator God. It's worth dwelling on for just a second, because it would be hard to take in the measure of those words in just a short space of time. I don't know what you believe about God at the moment. You may not believe that there's a God there at all. You may think that if there is a God who's there, he's rather weak and decrepit and in old age and about to fizzle out completely, as Philip Bullman would have us believe if you've ever read any of his books. You may not be sure what you think. The claim of the Bible is that there is a God who is there. And he's not some weak God that needs us to feel sorry for him. Rather, he's a God who made the whole world and everything in it. More than that, he continues to sustain the world so that he's the one who gives us our life and our breath. He puts as one verse in the Bible puts it, he puts the food on our plates and the laughter, the joy into our hearts. He's a God who controls the times and seasons. He brings up empires and then he brings them low. He's a God who is who is perfectly perfect in every way. So much that there's not even the faintest trace of any sort of evil in him. In fact, so pure is he cannot even look upon evil when he sees it in someone or something else. We're talking of a God who is majestic, almost beyond our comprehension. A God who is awesome in every way, a God who is almighty. More than that, a God who is completely satisfied in himself, has no needs. And a God who is completely satisfying to know. So we may be able to imagine what it would be like to stumble across a vast amount of treasure and the joy that that would bring to our life. Well, the Bible describes knowing God as being worth more than much pure gold. Or we may be able to imagine or remember, maybe even from this afternoon, the taste sensation of honey passing our lips. Well, the Bible speaks of the possibility of knowing God as being sweeter than much honey. Or again, when Jesus comes and speaks, he also tries to set our taste buds running, I think. So when he describes himself to drink, I don't know if you've got a favourite drink. I confessed in the 4 o'clock service that my favourite drink in the whole world, I think, at the moment, is a real ale called Coniston Bluebird. It comes from the Lake District. It's brewed just out the back of a pub in Coniston. And on the side of the bottle, if you ever see it, you buy it in Borough Market, actually. Slightly more expensive than it is in the Lakes, but anyway. It says on the side of the bottle, best served at the Black Bull Inn in Coniston at 57 degrees Celsius in a straight glass, obviously, and importantly. Well, it is my favourite thing. I've made a pilgrimage there once, actually, to go and taste it in its source. But even when you drink it, whatever your favourite drink, you know a few minutes, hours later, you'll be thirsty again. When Jesus tells us what it's like to know him, he says, if you drink of knowing me, well, you'll never thirst again. We could do it with food. I don't know if you've got a favourite plate of food. I'm sorry to set your taste buds so salivating just as we're starting. There'll be plenty of time to go and eat later, I'm sure. And for me, my mum's roast beef and Yorkshire pudding and all of the trimmings. It's slightly harsh to say that when I've been married for 8 years, but mum's dish still slightly comes out on top of the pots, I have to say. But again, eat it, and I know that I'm going to be hungry again within a matter of hours or certainly a day or so. When Jesus tells us what it's like to feed on him, he says, well, feed on me and you'll never go hungry again. So the offer on the table is this possibility of knowing God, the awesome, majestic creator God, and we're being told it's taste bud-tastic, if I can put it like that. It's so wonderful, it's hard even to express just how good a thing it would be. We could know that God with such an intimacy that we could call him our Father. It's no small thing that we're talking about. But quite often when churches run weeks like this, a question that comes to mind as people go through is, well, that's all very well and good. Maybe you came to a dinner and you were beginning to agree conceptually with some of the things that were being said, but you found yourself wanting to ask the question, but what would it look like in practice? What would it mean for me personally if I were to be a follower of Jesus? I've got bills to pay, I've got a job to do, I've got a family to raise maybe, or I'm hoping to one day. What's it going to mean in the day-to-day nitty-gritty of life for me to be a follower of Jesus Christ? Well, that's the question that our passage tries to answer today. And it comes, there'll be two main points I think that I'm going to be making. The first one from verse 34 is the pattern. Jesus calls his followers disciples, learners. And the pattern of discipleship is all about following him. So let me read verse 34 again, and then we'll work through the little bits of it together. Jesus called to him the crowd with his disciples and said to them, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. You'll see that Jesus is speaking not just to his disciples, the persuaded followers, if you like, but to the crowd as well. It's important we see that. It means that what Jesus is about to tell us here isn't some sort of postgraduate level, PhD level, super Christianity for the religiously elite. This is entry level stuff for anybody and everybody. You want to know what it is to be a Christian? Wherever you're coming from, wherever you're starting, it looks exactly like this. Denying myself, taking up my cross and following him. Actually, there's only two occasions in Mark's gospel where Jesus deliberately calls the crowds to himself. And whenever he does it, he's going to make a statement of universal significance. And here it is, he's telling us, what does it mean to be a disciple? And you'll see that in its essence, it's about following him. It's all about him. Now, the crowds have been following Jesus physically or coming after him. Those two phrases have been used quite a lot in Mark's gospel up until this point, throughout the gospel so far. But it seems now that Jesus is after a different kind of follower. He's trying to sort out the wheat from the chaff. He's trying to distinguish between those who are merely along for the ride and those who are the real article. He's wanting to say to them, is your interest in me merely fleeting and superficial? Or is it the real thing? And so he calls the crowd to him. If anyone wants to be one of my followers, if you want to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. And to deny myself is very simply to say, Jesus, it's no longer me and my will that matters. From here on in every area of life, it's all about you and your will. I suppose at root the issue is, who is the boss? We all know what the boss is. The boss is the person who calls the shots in life. Well, who's the boss of the Christian's life? The answer is that I deny that I myself am my own boss. And in its place, I affirm that Jesus is in charge instead. Remember, Jesus is God. So objectively speaking, he is already the boss. But what he's asking me to do here is to open up my eyes to reality and to begin to live in the light of the fact that is manifestly true, that Jesus is God. I'm to stop running life my way without him, and I'm to submit instead to his wise and loving rule. Of course, if you've ever thought about it, even for a moment, you'll know that that is not an easy thing to do. And there are some who have enormous problems with it, and I can see why. And we're taught from such a young age, aren't we, to be independent, to stand on our own two feet, to look after number one. And so the thought of moving over and letting someone else drive, as it were, feels wrong somehow. Jean-Paul Sartre described it as an act of inauthenticity against your whole being to surrender your autonomy to somebody else. And we kind of know what he means. We're nervous of Jesus. We're suspicious of him. Particularly those of us that are in any way semi-established in life. We think we're doing okay already. Things are going fine. We're worried that if we were to let Jesus be the boss, that somehow he might harm us or make us settle for second best, and we'd do better to carry on without him. Well, I want to say that I think that's nonsense. Just think of the extent of Jesus's commitment to me. First of all, he made me and gave me life. And then he was willing to die for me. You'd have to ask, if Jesus wanted to harm me or manipulate me or take away some of the good stuff in my life, do I really think that he would have gone to all of the trouble of dying for me? Well, it doesn't seem very likely. The king on the cross wants to love me forever. He doesn't want to compromise my humanity and destroy me. Sure, there are times, there are areas of life when the will of Jesus, as it becomes clear to me, is transparently in conflict with my own. In our generation, it will often be something to do with sex, or maybe my attitude to drink or to drugs, or what Jesus has to say about my use of money. It could just be the desire to be in control. And in those moments, because Jesus is a good and a kind boss, I can trust that he has my best interests at heart. He isn't like some tyrannical oppressor who wants to rob me of all of my assets and then feast off them for himself. He's more like a perfect parent. In February, when all the snow was coming down, I was staying in Birmingham for a week and living with a family who had a couple of little children. And The children's logic on weather, I think being in Birmingham, they hadn't seen the sun terribly much in the last few years of their life. And so there they were, the sun came out, and even though there was loads of snow all over the ground, their logic was sun equals hot, and therefore we ought to go out and play. Pretty much naked in the snow, and a snowball fight naked was pretty much what the three-year-old boy wanted to do. He could not work out for a minute why his mum was insisting on thick socks and welly boots and coats and jackets and hats and gloves. He just wanted to be out there. He could not for a minute see that his mum might have his best interests at heart. Can I say it is something like that with Jesus? There are times when my will comes into conflict with his. But in those moments, I can trust. And it's an ongoing Christian battle to do this, but I can trust that, like a perfect parent, he knows better. He made life. He invented life. He knows how it works best. And so I need not to scream and shout about it like a petulant toddler and throw all of my toys out of the pram. I need to trust him. I need to forget about myself and my will, and I need to follow his instead. First up then, if I want to know what it would be like to be a follower of Jesus, it would be about denying myself, welcoming Jesus as my boss. The second phrase that Jesus uses in verse 34 says much the same thing again. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross. Back in the first century, it's a really striking image, this. The only people in the first century who ever carried a cross were condemned criminals as they were marched to the place of their execution. Something that Jesus himself would have to do in chapter 15 of Mark. So he could hardly have picked a more sobering image to say, well, this is the life of the genuine Christian. Death. Don't know if you've ever seen footage from the States, maybe in a film, maybe in a documentary, of someone being taken from their cell on death row to their execution. And you've heard the gates slam behind them for the last time, and the guard call out that phrase, dead man walking. And you've watched the convict take the final few strides of life. Jesus is saying there is a sense in which each and every one of his followers is a dead man, a dead woman walking. That the characteristic of the Christian life will be death. For some of Jesus' first hearers, that was very literally the case. They would be martyred for believing in Jesus Christ and following him in a culture in which you had to say that Caesar was Lord. So to say that Jesus was Lord was dangerous. And still around the world, that happens to many. I think the latest estimates are about 171,000 people a year are killed for no other crime than believing in Jesus Christ. But although not every Christian will go to their literal death in that way, every Christian will die metaphorically, as there is a death to that old independent way of life in which I'm in charge and I begin to follow Jesus instead. What does it mean to be a Christian? It means denying myself, taking up my cross, and following him. Can you see? He's talking about a whole new center to my being. Him, right at the center of everything. He's saying from now on, when I think about how I use my money and my body and my time and my talents and my home, and if I've forgotten anything, it's not intentional. Everything about me, from this moment on, the person who will govern my thinking and my decisions will no longer be me, but Jesus. We need to stress that Jesus is not setting a pass mark here. He's not saying, your life isn't quite up to scratch, but if you go away for 6 months and work on it and you begin to live like this, then you can come and be one of my followers. Now, the only way anyone ever begins in the Christian life, as Marcus has said already this evening, is by trusting in the death of Jesus Christ. But what he is doing is describing the shape that the life of his disciples will take as they follow him. He's saying the increasing characteristic of people who follow him will be a complete abandonment of the self to Jesus. As the German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer once put it, when Christ calls a man or woman, he bids them come and die. Well, Jesus is laying it on pretty thick to the crowd, isn't he? But you can see exactly what he's doing here. He's saying to a group, I guess much like ours, well, look, it's lovely. You obviously know enough about me and are interested enough in me to be willing to follow me around and hear me preach in the different villages of Palestine. But what's really going on? Are you a real Christian or are you a fake? It was exactly the right question to ask that crowd. The phrase "the crowd" comes up about 40 times through Mark's gospel. If you were to take away the book and read it through, they make an interesting character study. Early on, they're thrilled with Jesus. They hear his teaching and they say, we've never heard anything like this. They see him do miracles. They say, we've never seen anything like this. They can't get enough of him. And yet by the end of the gospel, the very same crowd, it seems, are screaming for him to be murdered. Crucify him. Crucify him. They'd looked so promising, so hungry. The reality is that the vast majority were fakes. You found them in every religious gathering, I think. Maybe there's people who go to church to keep their family happy or a friend, or they're willing to ask lots and lots of questions about things, but they're not really willing to listen to the answers. Superficial, it's fleeting interest, but it's not heart engagement. Could happen for any number of reasons. There's a guy a few chapters earlier in Mark called Herod, and the thing that got in the way for him, he was greatly intrigued by the teaching of Jesus, but for him there was just this particular act of rebellion against God in his life. It was a particular inappropriate relationship, and because he simply wouldn't let go of it, he wouldn't follow Jesus. The Pharisees are the religious leaders of the first century. They, as you read through Mark, you see they're deeply committed to their own religious traditions. They're so firmly committed to them and their own ideas of God that they wouldn't make room for Jesus. And Jesus is turning to the crowd and saying, you just here for the ride? Or will you forget about yourself and take up your cross and follow me? God doesn't just want some of your time. I guess if he did, we could probably find him a few hours. And he doesn't just want some of your money. I guess if he did, we would probably all shell out. What he's saying he wants is to call the shots in your life. He's saying he wants the death of your independence. He's saying he wants your heart. He wants you. Of course, that's the one thing that most of us don't want to give him. We think the price is too high. We think he's asking too much. Even as I've explained it again today, I've thought, it just seems a bit steep, doesn't it? Why would anyone ever want to follow Jesus? And I think Jesus anticipates the question. And having taught us that the pattern of discipleship is to follow him, he moves on in the next few verses to give us you could call a motivation for discipleship. His purpose in the next few verses is to attack that knee-jerk reaction that wants to say to him, no way. The thing that wants to cling on to this world and my independent way of life. And he wants to show me that because of what will happen in the future, it makes perfect sense today, even though it's hard, to follow him in the way he's just been talking about. So this then, the motivation for discipleship is knowing the future. So in verse 34, Jesus says, come and follow me. And then if you glance down at the bottom of page 23 there, I'll read verse 35. For here's why to follow me. Whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. That is, if your first instinct after verse 34 is to say, there is no way that I'm denying myself. There is no way that I'm taking up my cross. Then Jesus wants to say, you ought to be warned. Because if you want to save your life now, if you want to maintain your independence from God now in this life, well, you'll be destroyed for all eternity. But if you surrender your life to Jesus now, you'll find that he gives you eternal life. So what's it to be, says Jesus? Verse 36. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his life? For what can a man give in return for his life? I'm sure some of you are in business, or you want to be one day, you want to make your mark on the commercial world. Well, here, says Jesus, apply your commercial sense to this one then. Maybe we'll feel the force if I ask you to think for a moment of the thing to which you aspire most in life. I think that when you're sitting there dreaming in your armchair, your mind flicks over into neutral and you think, if I could just have that, everything would be okay. Actually, why not make a list of your top 10? You've probably got more than one that's flooding through your mind at the moment. And let me ask you to imagine that you get them all 10 of them come true. And the next 10 on your list. And the next 10 after that as well. In fact, you get everything that you've ever wanted in life. Well, how would it end? There you are in your hospital bed, I guess. You've lived on to the ripe old age of 125 or something like that. And your body is still in fully functioning order. You're still proud of your six-pack. You're not sagging in all the wrong places. It's all going brilliantly. And you've got a fully functioning mind as well. Everything is working up there. And your marriage, your 95-year-old marriage, however many it is, that's been the very definition of happiness. And your business career, the very definition of success. You've far supplanted Bill Gates and others in the history books of economics. And there you are in your hospital bed. And you've got all of your children there. 12? How many? I don't know how many would it be. Let's say 2. Both of them are there. And your grandchildren are there as well. And your great-grandchildren. And you know, because it mattered a lot to you, that you've given those kids the best start that they could have in their life. And wonderfully, you've seen each of your own children marry. And you've seen the grandchildren marry. And you've been in there in your hospital bed this afternoon. They've all come to visit. And it's just the very picture of family bliss. Everyone is getting on brilliantly with each other. There's none of those grudges and resentments that sometimes hurt families. Everybody loves each other perfectly. And the great-grandchildren have been bouncing on your knee. And it's just been the perfect afternoon. And you say goodbye to them. And then that night, you die quietly in your sleep. In other words, you've gained the whole world. You've had everything that you've ever wanted. But you never did become a follower of Jesus. Well, picture yourself there that night as you die and you meet Jesus as your judge and he condemns you to hell. And ask yourself, was it worth it to gain the whole world and forfeit your soul? Of course it wasn't worth it. Of course it wasn't worth it. What could you give to get your soul back at that moment? Nothing. Once it's gone, it's gone. I mean, if your soul wasn't worth very much, if it was just of the same sort of value as a little Bic biro or something, you could just leave it lying around in an office somewhere. It doesn't matter. You lose one, you pick up another one, you run out, you go and buy a box full. It doesn't matter what you do with those things. You only have one eternal destiny. You only have one soul. Once it's gone, says Jesus. Lose eternal life. There's nothing you can do. There's nothing you can give to get it back. Buy your way out of most things in life, but not this. Let's see how Jesus wraps it up for us just over the page in verse 38. For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. I don't know what you make of Jesus at the moment. There are some who have pretty extreme reactions to Jesus, and I think that is right. I think the claims that Jesus makes in verses like these are so big and so extraordinary that we can say that if at the moment I'm basically apathetic about Jesus, then I haven't yet begun to engage with what he's got to say. We can make the mistake, I think, of confusing Jesus with someone who stands outside one of the tube stations with a bunch of flyers. There they are in the rain, holding them out limply, knowing they've got lots to get rid of and just desperately hoping that someone might be interested to take one of them out of his hand. Actually, that's not what Jesus is like. Jesus is much more, he's God. He's much more like someone from the bomb squad who bursts into your life and says, there's a bomb ticking in the corner of your heart, and if you don't do something about it, it will explode. Take action now. You can ignore the flyer and for as long as you like, but you ignore the bomb squad at your peril. I want to say, therefore, that if in any way you're thinking that it would be in your better interests to avoid the call of Jesus and not begin to be one of his followers, if you're thinking the price is too high, well, then you need to know that that would be a decision that would haunt you painfully for all eternity. I don't suppose there's anything more powerful in the whole world than knowing the future. If you could have gone back 3 years and you were wandering down a street and a bloke in a black suit, someone said, come into this room here, and he took you in a slightly dusty, smoky old room, and he opened up a computer and there showed you the future of the world for the next 10 years. So you had all of the, you were the first one to know exactly in detail what would happen with the economy over the last couple of years. You knew which stocks would collapse at which moment. You know how high the price of oil would go. You knew exactly how high the gold market would go. You knew everything. And you knew all of the sports results as well, in detail. Who would score, which minute. You had entire access to the future of the world for the next 5 or 10 years. I'm guessing you would want to put that information to work for you in the present. I'm guessing you would have sold your shares in the banks before they collapsed. You might have reorganized your pension a little bit. You might have bought some gold a long time ago. A lot of people thinking they wish they had. Well, if I can put it like this, today Jesus has disclosed to you your future. And not just the future of the world for the next couple of years, but your eternal future. And he said to you that if it is your settled decision to walk away from him in this life, then he will have nothing to do with you in the next. And he's called you. Instead, be willing to deny yourself and to take up your cross and to follow him. And if you were to do that, you would know that he would personally give you something that money cannot buy. Something, in fact, that's more precious than the whole world. Something that tastes sweeter than lots of honey on, that's better than your favorite drink, that's better than your favorite. You'll never thirst, you'll never hunger again. Something that good. Because he would give you eternal life. And I'm guessing you'd want to use that information. You'd want to use the knowledge of your certain future and put it to work in your present. As I close then, let me ask you to imagine a line that I draw, the length of the barge, that represents where you stand at the moment in relation to Jesus Christ. And up at that end of the line will be ignorance of him and hostility towards him. And then down at this end of the line would be love and devotion. Somewhere right here, I guess, in the middle would be verse 34. The moment that someone denies themselves and takes up their cross and follows him. And I think it would be a real help to you to try and plot yourself somewhere along the line. Where are you at in relation to the things that we've been talking about? Maybe that you came in today thinking that you were a follower of Jesus, that you're a Christian. But actually, there's no denial of self in your life. There's no taking up of your cross. And really, your will is enthroned and not Jesus. You've realized that actually you're down on this side of the line. Maybe you've came in today knowing you were somewhere back here. But as Jesus has disclosed to us our eternal future and the consequences for that future of the response that we make to Jesus in this life, you've thought to yourself, you know what, it would make sense to cross that line. I can see it would be painful. I can see that some things would have to change. But he is the boss, and so I want to acknowledge him as boss. I want to deny myself and take up my cross and follow him. If you were wanting to cross that divide, as it were, today, then I'm going to end by praying a prayer. Actually, I discovered when I got here today that they printed what's called a prayer of belief on the white insert just in the middle of your song sheet there. I'd love you to take a look at it. Just on the back of what's called a response card, that second little box there. There's no magic form of words. God is never more than a prayer away. You could respond to him at any time. Doesn't need to be in a religious building. Doesn't need to be with anybody else present. You could do it before you got home tonight. But that form of words would be about the kind of thing that you'd want to say. You'd want to say, well, I know, God, that my life hasn't been lived with you as my king up until this moment. Thank you that Jesus died to make it possible for me to have another chance. Please help me to follow him from now on. It won't be appropriate for everybody here to pray that kind of prayer. But it will be, I hope, for one or two. And if you want to make today the day where you become absolutely clear in your mind that, yeah, I'm definitely a follower of Jesus, not a long for the ride one, but a real one, well, then I'm going to end by praying this prayer phrase by phrase. And you could just repeat it in the quietness of your heart as I read through it. Lord Jesus, I recognize that you are God and have the right to control my life. I have rebelled against you, sinning in thought, word, and deed, sometimes unconsciously, sometimes deliberately. I'm sorry for the way I have lived and ask you to forgive me. As best as I can, I want to turn away from rebellion and obey you. Thank you, Lord Jesus, for dying for me on the cross. Please come into my life and take complete control of it. Amen.